Welcome, everyone. Let's have an AA meeting. My name's Tim, and I'm an alcoholic.
Amen.
Welcome to the Monday Night Blue Chip Speakers Meeting at the NABA Club. We're a member of Alcoholics Anonymous with 1 year or more of sobriety tells his or her story.
I'm Jeff. I'm an alcoholic.
Amen.
All right, so the NABA Monday Night Blue Chip Speakers Meeting. This reading is based on a passage from page 29 of the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. Each individual in our personal stories describe in their own language and from their own point of view the way they established their relationship with God. These give a fair cross-section of our membership and clear-cut idea of what has happened in their lives. We hope no one will consider these self-revealing accounts in bad taste. Our hope is that many alcoholic men and women in the room tonight and then listening later on aabluechipspeakers.org desperately in need will hear our speaker and will believe that it is only by fully disclosing ourselves and our problems that any of us shall be persuaded to say, yes, I am one of them too. I must have this thing. Now introduce the speaker. So it's my pleasure to introduce Kelly. Kelly is an amazing person. I've known her for a while, and I just know that she's got a great passion for her program, and she gives such great advice to me and to everyone in her circle, and she's funny, she's smart. I love her to death, and I know you will too. So thanks, and Kelly Rice.
Hi, I'm Kelly. I'm an alcoholic. I am pretty nervous, though. Oh, my God. My sobriety date is April 21st, 2016. I have a sponsor. My sponsor has a sponsor. I have sponsored other women, and I am available to sponsor other women. My home group is the Alpharetta Group in Alpharetta. Surprise. And their business meeting is the second Tuesday of the month. So, yeah, that's all the obligatory stuff I think you're supposed to say in the beginning of the meeting. My sobriety date is April 21st, 2016. I started coming to AA when I was 17 years old. I'm going to be 40 next month, so I know I look good, right? No, but seriously, there's a lot of relapse in my story, and there's also a lot of sobriety, but that doesn't have to be your situation. You can come up here, come into this program, and definitely pick up one white chip. I know a lot of people in my life. My father's one of them. He's also in the program. Who they're like one white chip, and that's it, and that's all it has to be. But I guess I'll start with just what it used to be like, So I was born in Miami, Florida. My parents are divorced. They got divorced when I was very young. They got divorced when I was 3 years old. My dad got sober when I was 10. So my life was really interesting, I guess, in the beginning. I have two great parents. I had a very good lifestyle. I'm upper middle class upbringing. But I guess like my dad, when my parents got divorced, he had custody like on the weekends and every Tuesday nights kind of thing. And he just didn't know what a babysitter was. So he just brought me everywhere with him. I was exposed to, like, a lot of things. And, it was pretty glamorous and kind of cool, but really not the life that you're supposed to be around. I mean, I knew about drugs very early on. I knew about cocaine very early on. I knew about pot very early on. And I knew my dad was an alcoholic. He was in Vietnam, and he was shot, and so he has like a prosthetic. He has a fake leg, and so he used to get drunk, and he'd always be drunk. And I would call my mom to come pick me up, and I would call her, and I would say, oh, my dad's leg hurts. Can you come get me? That was kind of like, and then I started getting scared to be with him. Not because he wasn't abusive. He was a very friendly drunk. It was just I was scared to be in the car. I was scared to be around it. I just didn't like to be around it. It wasn't stable. I went to a lot of bars, a lot of parties, a lot of things. Like when he lost his license, he had for a DUI. We had a limo. I was getting picked up in a limo for a year. I mean, it was just very wild, very fast life in Miami. I mean, that's what Miami was like in the 80s: cocaine and alcohol, and that was it. My mom got remarried when I was 6 years old, and my stepfather, he's since passed. He passed in 2012. He was a dry drunk. So he had been sober for many years, and he used to work a program, and then he stopped going to meetings and stopped, obviously, working a program, working with sponsees and a sponsor and whatnot. And that's pretty miserable. That's like a pretty miserable state. And he wasn't a nice guy. He was like a very emotionally abusive and physically abusive person. And so that went on in my childhood too. So when we grew up in Miami, I can tell you, I got so nervous. So anyways, like when I was really young, when I was in kindergarten, they passed like the new laws that you were supposed to be a certain age to go on to first grade. And my dad threw a fit, and he was like, no, she's going to go to first grade. She's not going to be held back because of her age, because of her birthday. So he had me take like an IQ test, and they passed me forward. And I can clearly remember feeling like the rules don't apply to me. Like, that was something, and that's something that's definitely throughout my life. Rules don't apply for me, or I'm in charge, I run stuff. That's definitely, like, a theme throughout my life. So I thought that was important to say. Like, that was introduced to me at a very early age. You can talk yourself out of anything. You can get out of trouble. The rules don't apply. And I definitely proceeded to live my life like that for the next, 20-plus years. But like I said, my mom got remarried when I was 6, and when I was nine, we moved to Pensacola, Florida. I was really very, very, very unhappy about that move. I had a lot of resentment, and I started acting out, because it was like I grew up in Miami, my friends, my father was there. I didn't want to leave, and I started having a lot of resentment against my stepfather. I went to a really small private school in Pensacola. Like there was about 200 kids in the whole school from preschool to eighth grade. So it was very small, advanced, gifted school. And it was a great school, a lot of great experiences. But I would say around the first time that I ever drank, I guess I was nine. I actually thought about this the other day. I was nine the first time I ever drank. My dad had like a bachelor party at his house. I mean, not like the full-on bachelor party with strippers and stuff, but like the pre-bachelor party where they were having the dinner and there was a keg and everything. And my best friend, Kathy Burns, and I, like, we went after everybody had kind of like passed out and left. We went and started like drinking all the wine glasses, and we couldn't figure out how to operate the keg. But that was the first time I ever drank. I don't remember getting drunk, but I do remember, like, the sneakiness of the whole thing, and I really liked that. Like, that was very fun to me, and we felt very old and adult. So that was my first experience. My next full-on experience was when I was 12 years old. I was with a group of my friends, and we were having a sleepover, and somebody had stolen a bottle of Creme de Menthe, and somebody obviously not experienced with alcohol, but that's what they stole. And then there was this over-the-counter stuff called Heads Up. It's like a speed for truckers or something, truck drivers, like to keep you awake. And so we took a bunch of that, and we were smoking a Camel Wide with like no filters on them. I know, it's like a really disgusting combination. So you can imagine like a bunch of 12-year-old girls, we got really drunk, we thought we were really cool, and then the next day we did not think we were really cool because we were very sick. It was terrible the next day. But I did like the feeling. For me, there's a lot of drugs in my story. I'm also a heroin addict, and drugs were my first like real love, and then the alcohol came in. But like, don't be fooled, I'm a full-blown knee-walking, blackout drinking alcoholic. So alcohol definitely played a big role in my life too. It's just, when you're younger, at least I found it was always easier to get drugs. It was always easier to get drugs than it was alcohol. As a kid, like, it's always easier to get pot to me. I don't know, that's how it was. But I started smoking pot around the eighth grade. And by my freshman year of high school, I was 13 because I told you I went ahead. I was like a wake and baker every day, smoking pot, skipping school. I failed for truancy. I know, dream big. but I was starting to get in trouble a lot. I was starting to get in trouble. I mean, like, I was all in AP classes, advanced classes, and so it's like the intelligence was there. but I had a lot of behavioral issues. I was super disrespectful to teachers. I was so embarrassed saying this stuff, but it's true. I was sneaking out. My mom, like, they bolted my screen in. Like, they screwed the screen into the window, so like I couldn't get out because I popped it out. And then I just, like, would cut it up the side, and I would tape it open and shut. But my neighbors had these two poodles that would always get me busted sneaking out. You know, but, like, that kind of thing. I mean, so I was always sneaking out, getting in trouble. Like, I failed for truancy. That was actually my sophomore year. You know, just all of the things. And the drug use definitely started to escalate. It's, like, I guess back then, like, what we were doing, roofies were really popular, acid, pot, mushrooms, I mean, ecstasy, everything. We were doing everything. I was a troublemaker. And I was like the kids you didn't want your kids to hang out with. I wasn't influenced by the other kids. I was definitely the influencer. So when I, like, after I failed my sophomore year for truancy, and things were a mess in my household, obviously. I mean, I was obviously a part of the problem because of my usage and my behavior. But like I said, my stepdad wasn't, he was a big part of the problem too. And some neighbors had kind of gotten involved. And my dad used to come in town, like, for my birthdays. He got sober. He got sober when I was 11. And he's been sober ever since. And AA is a huge part of his life. He goes to 5 meetings a week, sponsors a ton of guys, and I've watched it transform his life, and it's been awesome, and it's been awesome for me too to have him in my life. But anyways, got sidetracked. The neighbors had gotten involved, and they kind of knew the stuff that was going on in the household, and my dad had come in town for birthdays and different things. So one of the neighbors got actually in touch with my dad and kind of, like, let him know, like, the abuse and stuff that was going on. It wasn't sexual abuse, but, like, physical abuse and verbal abuse. And so my dad said, you know, do you want to come live with me? And I was like, yeah, I definitely want to come live with you. And in Florida, you can choose when you're 13 who you want to live with. And my parents didn't make me do that. My mom didn't make me do that. You know, my mom really did the best she can. She's just one of those people. She's an amazing woman. She's super sweet, super codependent. Obviously, she married two alcoholics. But she just doesn't have a backbone. Like, she just couldn't, you know, she was living in a hard situation too. So she was really doing the best she could. But, you know, so I went to live with my dad is the bottom line. And that was like a teenager's dream because he works a lot, very busy. Like I said, he's a pretty successful guy. So I had a lot of resources. And my house, like, quickly became the party house. Yeah, like, you know, I got a car the day I turned 16, which was, like, probably a really big mistake, because my dad couldn't drive me to school. He, you know, didn't have the time. So, like, my house became the party house, and everybody was always at my house after school, and that's when I started doing cocaine, because in Miami, cocaine was, like, a pretty popular drug. The usual stuff, the usual trouble, the usual things. Like, I never had any trouble with the police or the law until, like, my 20s. But I was definitely, like, the notorious kid at school for having drugs. I was in a private Catholic school. And I got searched. I got, you know, in trouble. I didn't get kicked out. My dad made a donation, that kind of thing. I ended up, when I was a junior, going to my first treatment center down in Miami. I've been to, like, multiple treatment centers. I think I've been to 14 or 15. I was trying to add it up earlier today, but I've been to a lot. But that was my first one that I went to. And when you're 17 going to treatment, it can be one of two experiences. You're 17, you're going because your parents are forcing you to go, or you really want to get your life together. And I definitely know some 17-year-olds who have gotten sober. I just wasn't one of them. I went to treatment. I went to a three-quarter way house. I did that whole deal. And I stayed sober for about 2 years. I started drinking again and using, and I was lying, so I really don't know when I actually relapsed in that period of time, but I did. And I think, like, my story is pretty much from, like, that point forward, like, from that until about 30 years old, it was always a guy, it was always a treatment center, it was always, you know, guy, treatment center, get sober, relapse, guy, treatment center, get sober, relapse. And there's, like, a bunch of that. And I don't think I have to, like, go into a ton of details. It was, that was my pattern. I mean, I'd go to treatment, find a boyfriend, stay sober for whatever period of time, and get, you know, I didn't lose a lot. Like, that was the other thing. I never had a lot of consequences, right? So I never had, like, the financial consequences, and, you know, which was really crazy is I didn't, like, lose a lot of people either, even though my behavior was appalling, and a lot of people probably should have said bye. So that makes for, like, an alcoholic who we already have, like, huge egos. I had a huge ego. I wasn't a very nice person. I wasn't, you know, a nice person to be around. I guess, like, if you fast forward to about, like, that's what my life was like. And in 2012, I was living here. I'd moved to Atlanta. There was a lot of geographics. I had, like, lived in New Mexico, Portland, Miami, Alabama. I mean, a bunch of different places. Kind of like wherever I went to treatment, I'd end up living there for a while. You know, it's just one of those things. But I was living here in Atlanta, and I was working for a really good company. And I didn't even mention this, but I got introduced to heroin when I was 17 years old. And that's what I actually relapsed on. And I got introduced to it with some people from the other fellowship, NA, a different fellowship. And when I did that drug, that was like, I knew that was the drug for me. I didn't start doing it IV. I started off snorting it, and then, you know, of course, I ended up as an IV addict. I think that's the natural progression with that drug. But I'm living here in Atlanta, and in Atlanta, I'm sure you guys, like, see the news, and you know Atlanta's a huge heroin epidemic here. It's terrible. It's really bad. But for a heroin addict, that's like a dream. So I was in the right city. But I was working for this company, and I clean up nice. Like, you know, I'm a functioning user, which sounds really, really weird, but it's true. I mean, I clean up well. I look good. I can play the part. But it's really like I'm circling the drain and, like, trying to juggle all the balls and, like, stick my finger in the dam because, like, everything is about to fall apart. And I was in a crazy relationship, somebody else who was using, somebody I'd met from treatment years back. And I was driving home to my mom's house one day, and I nodded out, and I crashed into our neighbor's house. I was pretty high. Nobody was hurt, so, which obviously was, nobody else was hurt, and I wasn't hurt. But I was so euphoric and so out of it, I just didn't even realize, like, what had happened. And, like, they called the police, obviously, and I didn't realize I was about to get arrested. I mean, that's just how out of it I was. And I got arrested. I don't remember being booked or processed, but there's a mugshot on the internet. You can see it if you want, as evidence that I was really in jail. I got bonded out. I was already on probation for a DUI that I had. I got bonded out very quickly, and I went to detox, and I went to treatment. And that was the first time that I ever went to treatment. I did 7 months in treatment, that I got a sponsor, and I worked steps, and that I actually started taking the program at Alcoholics Anonymous seriously. I had always been going, like, for other people. I had been always doing it for somebody else. And, yeah, obviously, I was going to get into a lot of trouble. I mean, I got arrested with a ton of drugs. I had methadone and Klonopin and heroin, and I was already on probation, like I said, for a DUI. So, you know, shit was going to hit the fan. But I put myself in treatment. You know, my dad was kind of like, I'm not paying for it this time. I'm not doing it this time. He could probably feed a small country for what he has spent on treatment centers. But I went to a treatment center here. It wasn't like the fancy, glitzy treatment centers I've been to in the past. It's a place that is very special to my heart. It's called Tangu, even though it's kind of sketchy and weird. But I really did a lot for me. But I did 7 months of treatment there and got a sponsor, started working the steps, and got really, really, really involved. I ended up working at the treatment center afterwards while I was waiting for all my legal stuff to clear up. But my legal stuff did clear up, and I don't have any felonies on my record. And some consequences didn't stick. But I did get in a little bit of trouble, but not what I should have been. But I really started, I worked at the treatment center. I really started to have a life. By when I got to the ninth step, like the promises, like they were already coming true for me, making amends and building relationships with my family. I was engaged. I got engaged. I ended up getting married. A lot of really good things happened to me as a direct result of the program. But I had just over 4 years sober, and right before I got married too. And my ex-husband and I decided to drink together. And I can tell you this, like, if you're in a relationship with somebody from the program, if you're going to drink together, yeah, you're nodding. I don't know if you've done it or not, but it's really a terrible idea. And if you think it's going to, like, bring you closer together or help your relationship, it's not. It's like it's going to end in a disaster. And it did. And the reason why I bring that up is not because, I mean, that's what needed to happen. I mean, him and I aren't supposed to be together, and I'm totally okay with that. But the reason why I bring that up is because my marriage was the first consequence that, like, I actually couldn't talk somebody, you know, I couldn't talk myself out of. I couldn't buy myself out of. It was a real consequence that stuck. And I remember we started drinking together. This was about 3 years ago. We started drinking together. It was about a 9-month run that I went on. And if you hooked me up to a lie detector and asked if I was going to do heroin, I would have passed because I didn't think I was. Within, you know, 60 days, I was back as bad as I ever was before. And I just remember, like, I was in our condo in Buckhead, and I decided I was going to go to Blue Ridge for treatment. And I was in the condo, and I was packing things up to move out, and I had, like, all these beautiful things in this beautiful condo. And you would think, like, if you looked at my life, I had a really good job. Well, actually, I lost it. They sent me to treatment, but I had a good job. And everything else, you would think, this girl has a great life. But it was all external things, and I was always fueled by external things, the material things. And that was just the first consequence that I couldn't get out of. And I needed that to happen. And I went to treatment and got out. And I didn't stay sober immediately. I had two, like, week-long slips or relapses or whatever you want to call them. But when I decided... I went through a divorce. That was really tough, going through a divorce, more because of the shame and the guilt. And I was so embarrassed. And I was just so, like, that I couldn't make the marriage work, or just the feelings. It was really tough for me. I carried a lot of shame about that and embarrassment. Because I knew it was because of the drinking and my behaviors and his behaviors too, but it was just a really hard place. And I moved into my mother's house. I was, you know, geez, in my late 30s. I moved into my mother's house. I was like 38 years old and 37 years old. Moving back home to mom, that was a tough one. That was a humiliating thing. I didn't have a job, getting divorced, no job, no house, no nothing. And that's what I needed. I needed that humbling experience. I needed to get out of, like, living in town. And my mom lives in Woodstock, and that was... living there was tough because I just, being from Miami and being from a city and always living in a bigger city, living in Atlanta was one thing, but, like, living outside the perimeter was kind of hard, but it was definitely what I needed. I had just a lot of behaviors still that, like, that weren't serving me, that I needed to get rid of. And I really dove into AA and got a sponsor again and started doing everything that she told me to do. I mean, she would tell me, you need to call 3 women a day. I hated doing that. Not because I hate women. I just didn't want to call people. I mean, like, you can see it's, like, nervous for me to be up here talking in front of everybody. I didn't want to call people I didn't know and be like, hey, this is Kelly. I don't know, whatever. But she told me to do it, so I did it. I would pray for voicemails. You know, voicemails count, okay? I'm just telling you. As long as, like, it's taking the action. That's super important. So, yeah, I mean, going to meetings, connecting with women, you know, immediately got involved in working the steps again. And my life has changed a lot. And what I've realized is I didn't have to relapse before. I mean, I made that choice. I made a choice to stop going to meetings. I made a choice to stop calling my sponsor. I made a choice to stop sponsoring other women. I made a choice to stop taking commitments. And it took, like, it took about, I don't know, 4 months, 5 months of me not doing the things that I need to do for my life to unravel and for me to start drinking again, you know, and for me to say, oh, gosh, maybe I can take Vyvanse. No, I can't take Vyvanse. I don't have ADD that bad. You know, it's like, or maybe I can do this. Recently, I had surgery about 6 weeks ago. I'm fine. I mean, it's not like a big deal or anything. But I did it without pain meds. And that was like a huge, huge, huge thing. Everybody was kind of worried. Like, I know my friends were worried and people were worried. Like, am I going to do it, not do it? And I brought Jeff with me to the doctor and I immediately told him, you know, like, this is my history. This is the deal. I cannot have pain medication at all. And the doctor and the anesthesiologist, they were amazing. They actually knew about addiction. And they decided, like, we're not even going to give you fentanyl during the anesthesia, like, nothing. Because the anesthesiologist is like, I don't want you to go home and have a problem later on. And dealing with modern medicine, that's not the norm. I mean, usually they want to, like, dope you up with everything. But that's a really big deal for me to know that, like, the potpourri of drugs that I could have gotten and that I said no to all of them and I didn't want them, that was huge. That's like growth. Because before, I've had surgery and sobriety before and different things. And let me tell you, it's sick, but I was looking forward to it. So it's like a free lapse. Like, you get to get high and nobody can tell you shit about it because you're not losing your sobriety because you're allowed to be doing it because you're actually in pain. That's a huge switch. It wasn't worth it to me. And I did the holistic herbal drugs, and I was fine, and I didn't need it, and it was cool, and it was really neat going through that experience. I work for a really big company. It's called ADP. I don't know if you guys have heard it or not. And I recently had to go through a background check. That was really scary because I do have stuff on my background, not felonies, but ADP is pretty intense with their backgrounds. And so I felt like I was reliving my all the wreckage of my past, like, all over again, and all the things that I've done. But I cleared the background. So that was pretty cool. But the week in before it popped, my background flagged for that accident in 2012. I ended up with some misdemeanors. And they had me, this huge corporation had me write a letter explaining the circumstances. And so I did, and I was honest in the letter. I had a recruiter. She's like, I wouldn't say I still go to those meetings. I'm like, it's not like rehab. But I was trying to explain it to her. I was like, look, I'm just going to say what I think I should say, and I'm just going to be honest in this letter and, like, turn it over and leave it up to God. And it all worked out, which is pretty awesome. So that doesn't haunt me anymore from 7 years ago, even though it did for quite some time. I could say, like, in my life right now, I like to believe that God is everything or God is nothing, but there's definitely areas in my life that I'm still agnostic. When it comes to relationships with people, I like to insert my control. I'm definitely getting better about that. But it's hard. You know, it's hard sometimes to turn everything over. I just never had room in my life for a higher power. Everything was about external, material things, money, ego and self, and now it's not like that at all. I've definitely been able to get rid of a lot of things that weren't serving me before, and I've definitely noticed a lot of shifts recently. Anger used to be like a really fun thing for me. I can almost get high off of my anger, and I can be mean, and I'm good at it, but I'm also really good at being nice now. I've had some situations with some friends and some stuff recently, some people in my life that from before that probably shouldn't be in my life anymore, and I'm realizing that, and I'm not acting out like in ways that I used to. So I'm definitely seeing my emotional sobriety go through shifts now too, as a result of, you know, working the steps and having a program. I think that, you know, the only thing you have to do perfect, obviously, is not drink or not pick up. I'm sure there's drug addicts in here, too. But I will say, like, if you haven't got a sponsor and started working the steps, I mean, that's that's really what is like the life-changing stuff. I have to do it. I'm one of those alcoholics and addicts that have to have a program in my life, or else I'm a fucking basket case. And it comes out, and you'll see it in me. So I definitely think, like, the program to me is the first 164 pages of the big book. It's the 12 steps. The meeting is fellowship. And the fellowship is also super important because, you know, the people will definitely save you too. And having the friends and having the support are great. But the combination of the two is just magic. And then sponsoring other women or men. I'm currently not sponsoring anybody right now. I have definitely sponsored people, and I've sponsored a lot of people in the past, and that's definitely a component that I'm missing in my life, and I would definitely, I'm open for sponsors if there's anybody in here who needs a sponsor. I think that's like the magic, giving it back and giving it away. Appreciate it, and I hope you guys got something out of it, and have a good night.
Thanks for the courage. Really appreciate it. Thanks one and all for joining the Blue Chip Speakers Meeting tonight.
Let him hear.